It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferris. Coming up later, we'll look at an exhibit that asks parents to take a walk in the shoes of teens who are confronting drugs and other substance abuse issues.
First, after months of gradually warming relations, the United States is set to take another big step in rebuilding a relationship with Cuba.
Just days after he shared a historic handshake with Cuban President Raul Castro, President Obama is now signaling that he wants to take Cuba off the American government's list of nations that sponsor terrorism. So what could that mean for both countries going forward?
Joining us now to talk about the potentially historic move is Jennifer Lynn McCoy. She's director of the Americas Program at the Carter Center and professor of political science and director of the Global Studies Institute at Georgia State University. Jennifer, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, the president has announced his intention to take Cuba off America's terror list. Now, if this happens, how significant would it be?
Well, it's mostly important symbolically in that there have been very few reasons to keep it on the list for the last decade or so. Cuba had renounced terrorism, has not supported insurgencies. And so it's been a request from Cuba for a long time, but from a lot of people in the United States thinking that they should have been removed quite some time ago. It's also important in terms of relationship with Latin America, who had viewed it as well as generally U.S. policy toward Cuba as anachronistic and harking back to the Cold War, when they see the United States moving forward in terms of relations with Vietnam, with China, with others, and, you know, why was Cuba singled out to be treated separately? And finally, for Cuba, it is important because it does, that being on the state-sponsored terrorist list does carry with it financial penalties. Now, removing it from this list will not lift all of the financial restrictions that the U.S. has on dealing with Cuba, but it will remove a few of them that affect banking around the world. Right now, no multinational or international bank wants to deal with Cuba or the Cuban intersection in Washington because of the heavy penalties that the U.S. puts on, partly because of this list.
Now, to tackle one of those questions, why has it taken so long for relations with Cuba to begin to normalize?
Well, that has mostly to do with domestic politics in the United States, in that there are very influential people in Congress who have very vocally and with success lobbied to keep the U.S. embargo, trade embargo against Cuba, economic embargo against Cuba in place for the last 50 years. And there had been a strong public opinion in Florida, and because Florida is an important electoral college state, every time elections come around, presidential candidates always pay attention. Now, however, not only is majority public opinion in the United States against the embargo in Cuba, but now opinion within Florida and even within the Cuban-American community, that is, exiles or children of exiles living in Florida from Cuba, the majority are in favor of lifting the embargo, removing the embargo, as well as normalizing relations with Cuba.
Now, to get a little bit of context here, you know, via history, how did Cuba end up on this list of countries that harbor terrorism to begin with?
Well, they were put on the list by President Reagan back in 1982. Previous to that, Cuba had supported revolutionary movements, insurgencies, guerrilla movements in Africa and Latin America. By 1982, it was beginning to reduce that support, but President Reagan put them on the list at that point in time. And they were kept on the list for that, with the justification that they provided safe haven to some members of the Basque separatist movement, considered terrorists by Spain. And that's a separate a piece of Spain that would like to break off. And also the FARC guerrilla insurgency in Colombia, who had also safe haven in Cuba. However, both of those governments have expressed for years that they actually appreciate Cuba's role in keeping some of those members of those two insurgencies, and most recently in helping to facilitate peace talks with them. So right now, Cuba is hosting peace talks between the Colombian government and this Colombian insurgent group, the FARC, which is very important as it's the last civil war in this hemisphere and is hopefully will end within the next year or so.
I'm going to look at another aspect of this, something that is on the table, the opening of embassies. What would that take and what would it mean?
Well, it won't mean a lot in terms of what we see on the ground, in that both countries already have what are called interest sections, which were opened during the presidency of Jimmy Carter. So we don't have ambassadors. We have people who are representatives of the countries in the interest section, but they basically function as ambassadors, and there are diplomatic staff who function there, and they approve visas for people traveling back and forth, et cetera. But this, but having these current buildings that they're housed in be renamed as embassies is symbolically important because it does reflect that both countries are now recognizing the other as, in diplomatic terms, you know, as a legitimate country to deal with. And what the U.S. is really trying hard to negotiate is to have much more freedom of travel of the diplomats to be able to travel around Cuba. In both countries, currently, there are restrictions on their diplomats to travel. So the diplomats from Cuba who live in Washington must get approval if they want to travel, say, to Wisconsin and give a talk. They have to get approval from the State Department. And likewise, U.S. diplomats in Cuba have to get approval if they want to travel outside of Havana. So the U.S. would like to lift those restrictions and have it operate as a normal embassy in any country. And they're still negotiating that point.
How do the U.S. and Cuba both stand to benefit when it comes to economic gain with this change?
Well, there are some slight changes. For example, President Obama said that he would now approve U.S. companies, telecommunications companies, to help improve internet access, cell phone access within Cuba. U.S. companies are currently restricted from helping provide those services in Cuba. That would be very important for Cuban citizens who have restricted access to the internet and to cell phones, et cetera. So that could be very important for Cuban citizens in terms of having much greater access to a variety of sources of information than they currently do. Of course, the Cuban government will have to approve the entry of these new telecommunications companies. But it's very important to note that normalizing relations does not mean the economic embargo is lifted. That is controlled by the U.S. Congress. So that would be a decision of the U.S. Congress to lift the economic embargo. The economic embargo is what restricts trade between the countries, restricts U.S. companies from being able to invest or to trade with Cuba, to sell products to Cuba, and restricts what American citizens can do in terms of spending money in Cuba.
We're talking right now about the president signaling that he's looking to take Cuba off the American government's list of nations that sponsor terrorism, talking about what that might mean right now with Jennifer Lynn McCoy, director of the Americas Program at the Carter Center. And Jennifer, you mentioned that a lot of the opposition to this kind of thing has eroded over the years, but there is still some pretty formidable resistance in Congress, at least, and among some in the Cuban community, among those the fear that it could weaken U.S. security. What are people saying about that?
Well, some, for example, presidential candidates have come out against it. Marco Rubio is against it. And as I said, some, you know, powerful members, particularly Cuban-American members of Congress, do oppose any relaxation of relations with Cuba. However, I don't see that it's going to threaten the United States at all. Instead, it's going to allow American citizens the freedom to travel to Cuba, eventually perhaps to invest and trade with Cuba, as I said, if the embargo were to be lifted in the future. So right now, it's mostly travel and engagement of citizens to citizens. This is the country in the world that the U.S. restricts its own citizens from traveling to. And so this is a restriction on U.S. citizens currently, and that's what President Obama is trying to change in part with this by making it a little bit easier for Americans to go for educational purposes. It's still restricted. Tourism is not permitted. It must be an educational or cultural trip, or journalism or church-related trip.
Now, the president has said that restoring ties with Cuba, it's not going to be a silver bullet that fixes all the problems. The two countries still don't see eye to eye on all issues. What do you see as some of the sticking points that still remain as we wrap up?
Well, the U.S. would still like Cuba to become a democracy with competitive elections and multiple political parties. That's the U.S. goal. And Cuba is resisting that. It has a single party, the Communist Party. They do have elections, but there are restrictions on who can run in those elections. And the U.S. has concerns about human rights and freedom of expression and, as I said before, access to information for the Cubans. So those are areas where the two countries still disagree. The U.S. would still like to press for changes in those areas. And that's part of that's a large reason, the main reason why the U.S. embargo is still in place.
Jennifer, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Jennifer Lynn McCoy, director of the Americas Program at the Carter Center and professor of political science and director of the Global Studies Institute at Georgia State University. She joined us to talk about the president's call to take Cuba off the country's terror list. We're continuing our conversation about President Obama's move to take Cuba off the list of state sponsors of terrorism. Unless Congress blocks that change with an unlikely joint resolution within 45 days, looks like it will come to pass.
It's a big step in an ongoing effort to normalize relations between the U.S. and Cuba. Now we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you think about starting a new chapter in U.S.-Cuban relations? And you personally, if a travel ban is lifted, would you want to go there? Have you been to Cuba under some of the exceptions to the travel ban? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can comment on the Central Time Facebook page. We've got Joseph on the line now in La Crosse. Joseph, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Hey, listen, this is just a really bad idea. A couple of years ago, one of the organizations that I work with sent some people there every year, and the number one thing they wanted was toothpaste and soap. Really? Because those aren't so hard to get here. This is a country where many things are true, but much isn't accurate. They talk about 100% literacy, but that just means people can read at a fourth grade reading level everything the government allows them to. They talk about universal health care, but doctors still wait a decade to be able to get a car. I have a friend whose mother was a doctor there until she managed to leave, and the family grew up there. Everything people think they know about Cuba is mostly wrong. It simply isn't true. It's a totalitarian dictatorship, and in celebration of the attempted renewal of relations with the United States, what does Cuba do? They go out and they pick up and they start harassing, 250 more people, political dissidents. This is not a group of nice people. This is a group of people who, under a heading in our country, would be listed as don't play well with others.
Joseph, thanks for the call. Taking your calls about U.S.-Cuban relations at 800-642-1234.
And we go next to Joe. Joe joins us from Madison. Hi, Joe.
Yes, hi. I wish that I had caught the first part of the last caller's comment. I was on the phone with your with the person that answered the phone. But I think I disagree with what he was saying about anything, but as far as my comment goes, I would like to see the embargo and all travel restrictions lifted. I think that the sanctions, the embargoes that the United States has put on Cuba were completely unjustified when they were instigated. I do understand why the United States has always held a sort of held Cuba with such disregard.
I'm going to have to leave it there, Joe. I've got a short bit of time there, but thank you so much for your call. Joe wants to see all of the restrictions released.
Back to our callers with John in Crystal Lake, Illinois. John, hi.
Hey, how's it going, guys? Just wanted to say I was there about a year and a half ago, my wife. Americans can go there. You just have to fly in from a different country. It's really not hard. It was an amazing experience. My wife is Brazilian, and I've done a lot of traveling in Latin America, so I thought I had a pretty good understanding of Latin American culture and whatnot. I speak Spanish, but it was an eye-opening experience and really sad. The Cuban people are kind of like little kids looking at the rest of the world through a window. They're prisoners, basically. They're very crafty people and smart, and we were ripped off continually. We were also lots of beggars asking us for, like your other caller said, for shampoo and T-shirts and hot dogs, whatever they weren't allowed to have. I would not want to do business with them. Can't trust any of them, especially the ones that speak English. Everything's controlled. Tourism is controlled. You have separate money for tours, and it's like the other caller also said, it's not like anything any of us can really understand.
Gotcha, John. Thanks for the call. You can keep the conversation going over at the Central Time Facebook page. Share your thoughts on the idea of normalizing relations with Cuba, and share your experiences if you've been to Cuba as well. Time now for Wisconsin Life. More than a century ago, an iconic cap was created by the wife of a cantankerous railroad engineer in Kaukauna. Nancy Camden went out to find the story behind the Stormy Cromer.
George Cromer began the company in 1903. I am Richard Grossman. I purchased the Cromer Cap Company in June of 1965 from George Cromer, the founder. He was an engineer on the old Chicago Northwestern Railroad. He used to sit up in the engine amidst all the wind and coal dust and cold blowing around.
My name is Nancy Going, and I live in the town of Cedarburg, Wisconsin. They were train engineers, so they had to stick their heads out the window to see what was coming up next or what was going on, and he lost a lot of hats.
Carl Strand. I live in Mequon, Wisconsin. Stormy Cromer, his wife, took an old wool baseball cap and sewed ear flaps on it for him.
And it drew the attention of his fellow workers, so she was asked to produce a few more caps. At the various stops along the train route, people took an interest in the cap, so that was really the birth of the Cromer cap business.
And I kind of wonder why it's not called the Ida Cromer hat, because, you know, she made it.
Ida manufactured as many as she could handle. Subsequently, as the company grew, they moved into Milwaukee.
I've got my Stormy Cromer as a Christmas gift from my husband. Mine is pretty enough that you could wear it anywhere, I think. But it's more of a sporty hat. It's not your Easter bonnet. If we get snow, it might be.
He used to own a semi-pro baseball team. A lot of the people that worked in his plant had to play on his baseball team. And he would get them out in the alley behind the plant and make them throw the ball and practice. He also had a theory that if you stared into the sun at great length, it would strengthen your eye muscles. He had some grandiose ideas in a number of different areas, and they didn't all work out. I think he was unique and had a specific personality. That's undoubtedly where the name Stormy came about.
Up here where we live on this farm, the wind blows and blows and blows all the time up here. The Stormy Cromer always stays on.
My name is Ron Heinrichs. We are living in Thiensville. When I'm skiing, I will pull the flaps down over my ears when I need it. Some folks refer to the Cromer cap as a modified Elmer Fudd hat because Elmer Fudd had he had a cap with a high dome on it, and the Cromer has a little bit of a higher dome.
The basic men's cap construction has stayed the same from the beginning. It was sold to a company
in Ironwood, Michigan, just across the border.
It's a very interesting, colorful history.
For folks that are in the know, they are a classic. The name is known.
Stormy Cromer caps.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. For more information, go to wisconsinlife.org.
According to the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction, nearly 20% of Wisconsin high school students are offered, sold, or given illegal drugs on school property. More than 30% of high school students have admitted to using marijuana or alcohol.
Parents of teens with substance abuse problems report how difficult it is to deal with the issue and how they struggle to find the right words to approach their children.
A new traveling exhibit currently on display at the Milwaukee Central Library is helping parents broach conversations about substance abuse with their kids.
Called In My Shoes, the exhibit was developed by teen patients at Rosecrans, a teen substance abuse program in Rockford, Illinois. It aims to put parents into the shoes of their teenage children who are struggling with addiction.
Joining us now is Jennifer Tomavong. She's certified alcohol and drug counselor and art therapist at Rosecrans. She's the creator of the In My Shoes exhibit. Jennifer, thanks for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, for those of us who haven't seen it, can you describe the exhibit? What would we see if we went and visited?
Sure. Basically, what you would see is shoes that were donated by staff. They were painted white by myself to represent a clean slate for the clients, a new start, and then they've decorated the shoes with their life story. So they've used different types of materials, art materials, to express themselves. They've put on their different symbols and different colors that represent basically what they've been through leading up to treatment.
So the artists in this case are teens who are actually going through treatment for substance abuse right now. Do I have that right?
Yes, that's correct.
So what kind of things do they put on the shoes? What kind of elements of their story are they trying to share with the world?
What they're trying to share is basically the idea and the knowledge that they don't want to be addicted. They don't choose that for themselves. There have been things that have happened in their lives leading up until that point. So for some of the clients, they wrote things about sexual abuse, other types of traumas. Some clients have written things about mental health and things that they've been trying to work through with that.
So on this side of things, as an art therapist, I mean, is this therapeutic for the people going through treatment to express themselves in this or other artistic ways?
Yes, I believe that art therapy allows the clients to kind of break down their defenses and express themselves through art and putting things out there that sometimes they don't even really realize that they're putting out there. And then some of our clients who struggle with putting things in words, it allows them to nonverbally express themselves and get those things out.
So why shoes in particular?
Well, we use primarily the 12 steps here at Rosecrans to help our clients work through their addiction. And so in using the 12 steps, shoes just seem to fit as far as following a life story or a life path, taking the steps that they need in treatment to build a life of recovery.
And then on the other side of this, we've been talking about the creators here. Let's go to the people who might come and see this. This is targeted in part to parents. What are you hoping that parents, especially parents of teenagers, take away from seeing this exhibit?
Basically hoping that parents will understand that teenagers' points of view and the pressures that they've had to go through, things that they've had to confront and basically bring them to substance use and allow them to have conversations with their teens or young teens to that can otherwise be uncomfortable. So instead of asking maybe more direct questions, they're able to ask questions related to the shoe art and make it a little bit easier for the parents to have those discussions.
We're talking to Jennifer Tomavong. She's an art therapist and an alcohol and drug counselor at Rosecrans. She's talking about this In My Shoes exhibit. It's currently on display at the Central Library in Milwaukee. It's going to be coming to the State Capitol Rotunda. The idea, it helps people going through treatment for substance abuse to tell their story and maybe share some lessons for parents and other teens. Invite your calls now at 800-642-1234. As a teen, did you deal with substance abuse? As the parent of a teen, Have you had conversations about this? Have you had a problem in your family? Do you not know where to start? And if you've used art as a form of therapy in your life, tell us about that too. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Jennifer, how important is it for parents to be able to start these conversations with their kids in the teen or maybe even preteen years?
I think it's important for parents to start these conversations because sometimes they can be proactive about it, and then that way maybe help keep their teens from beginning to use drugs, or if it's something that they've started to experiment with, to kind of stop that before it becomes more extreme.
And do you have a sense of what works for parents to start having this conversation with a teen, again, before a substance abuse problem happens or when there already is a problem or a suspected problem?
Mm-hmm. I think for parents, sometimes it's just knowing kind of just knowing your children in general. So maybe asking simple questions. Do they know people in their school that use substances? Are they aware of where they could go get help if they felt they needed to talk to somebody because someone had asked them to use substances in school? Basically, just really having a conversation with your kids in any way, shape, or form can be helpful.
And have you heard a response to the In My Shoes exhibit? Is this are you hearing from parents who say, yeah, this got the conversation started?
Yeah, there was actually one mother who came to the show when I happened to be there, and she had two younger children, had reported that wasn't a conversation that they had quite yet and didn't know really how to have that. And so she had mentioned that it was something she planned to bring up with them in the car, actually, because she felt it was less serious, a little bit more casual.
And you're not sitting across from each other. It can be a little easier to have those conversations when you all
right.
are looking in a different or all the same direction, I guess.
Hey,
let's go to a caller now at 800-642-1234. We've got John on the line in De Pere. John, hi.
Hey, guys. How's it going?
Good. What did you want to bring up, John?
Well, I am 24 years old now and have been struggling with, substance abuse since I was about 15 or 16, started with marijuana and, continued up higher to that. And it really caused a very significant burden on not only me but my family. And they still don't know to this day that I used to have a problem because I hid it from everyone. And I think that one of the biggest problems is these people don't want to come out because they're scared of people thinking they're an addict. And, once you're an addict, you're always an addict. And it's sad to see nowadays.
John, looking back, and thank you for sharing your story, but looking back, what do you wish you could have done at age 15? Maybe things could have come out different. Do you wish you, right off the bat, had been able to talk to your family about this?
Yeah, of course I wish I would have been able to. And I don't know, I was not comfortable. And I don't know if it was me or just the way they treated me that I wasn't comfortable talking to them about it. But I think I was just young and ignorant and wanted to do something to change how I felt at that time, which was probably confused, and drugs were an outlet as well as music, but drugs were terrible.
All right. Well, John, thank you for calling, and good luck to you as you continue to deal with these issues. Jennifer, do you think John's story is fairly common among the people you work with at Rosecrans, for example?
Yeah, I think, just being at Rosecrans and working with the adolescents, you learn that they do find it really difficult to talk to their parents about things. They're afraid they're going to be judged. They're afraid that they're going to have a label if they're in treatment. And so, really breaking that down and just letting the clients here at Rosecrans know that they're not alone. There are other people in similar situations and kind of helping them work through that. Being able to be honest with family because most of the time that's their biggest support. And if you can't be honest with them, who can you be honest with? I think we see that a lot.
Is there something a family can do to say, to make it clear that they're open to hear this and open to help, and they may not be wild about it, but it's not, judgment isn't the first thing they're going to bring to the table here?
Right. I think if parents just let their kids know ahead of time, or even if they find out that their kid is using substances, you know, that they're open to hearing what they have to say versus I think sometimes parents jump to conclusions and feel that doing that and reacting emotionally can help because they feel that it's, you know, being disciplined. But in reality, I think just being open, listening to what your kid has to say is probably one of the best things you can do.
We're talking about a new traveling exhibit, In My Shoes, that tries to put parents in the shoes of children with substance abuse problems. You can join our conversation. Do you think it's useful to approach a child's alcohol and drug abuse problems by trying to see it from that child's perspective? What's helped you in dealing with a similar situation? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue our conversation with Jennifer Tomavung. She's a certified alcohol and drug counselor and art therapist at Rosecrans, a Rockford, Illinois-based teen substance abuse treatment center. We'll continue the conversation and take more of your calls after a look at the news with Kristen Durst. We're talking about the challenges parents face in dealing with teen substance abuse problems and an art exhibit that helps put parents in the shoes of children who are grappling with that problem. The exhibit, In My Shoes, is at Milwaukee's Central Library.
We want to hear from you on this. What advice can you share as a parent of a teen who's going through this problem? Have you found it effective to approach the problem from your child's perspective? You can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Jennifer Tomavung stays with us. She's an art therapist, an alcohol and drug counselor, and the creator of this exhibit. Let's go back to our callers now. We've got Amy on the line in Madison. Amy, hi.
Hi there. Yeah, just a couple of things to point out. I, in high school, dabbled in a little bit of marijuana use. I was a really good kid, but tried it a few times, ended up getting caught at school. And then it seemed like by the next day, teachers, parents, you know, coaches, I was just shut out, you know, friends even. And that was extremely hard. But then secondly, I was thrown into like some intensive group therapy with kids who were doing a lot worse things than I was. And with having friends shut me out already, I kind of clung to that group and things really got worse for a few years.
Amy, thank you for calling in and sharing your story. So first of all, Jennifer, isolating, feeling shut out by what could be a support network.
Yeah, I think a lot of times parents and teachers have a hard time figuring out how to handle those types of situations. It seems that over time people have definitely become more open in trying to help teens with whether it be group therapy or really even just listening to where things are at. So I think the idea that substance use is only a particular type of teen is not the case anymore. I think people are definitely becoming more open to the realization that it could be anybody using substances.
And the idea of the scale of a response, she was saying that the situation, the particular therapy situation she was put in, actually exposed her to worse behavior, put her in a social network that was doing having a harder time than even she was at the outset. Do you see that as a problem sometimes? Is that something that's hard to avoid?
I think sometimes in a group therapy session, it's hard to make sure, you know, you obviously have to take into account everybody's in a different place. And so that's, I think, one of the biggest things that we try to do here at Rosecrans is meet clients where they're at. So if somebody else is kind of in a different place with their substance use, realizing that and making sure that they're getting the help that they need for that particular issue versus someone who might be deeper in their substance use, you know, taking that and battling that differently.
Amy, thanks a lot for the call. We'll go now to another caller at 800-642-1234. We've got Josh on the line in Madison. Josh, hi.
Hi. I think it's I used drugs recreationally when I was a teen, and after a serious accident, well, I became an opiate addict, and not that that was the first time that I used opiates, But I think there's an important distinction to be made between addicts and the occasional user. Like a teen that was caught smoking pot once does not necessarily need intensive treatment, but needs to be handled correctly by their parents or their guardians. And that it's tough to do. I think that any advice that I could give to parents is not to judge. And you earlier mentioned, I'm not sure what phrase you used, but you said, don't be afraid of talking to your parents because they are, or don't expect to be judged or something like that. But I think there is a lot of judgment that comes with the stigma of drug use and addicts. And that prevented me for the longest time in getting help. I've been clean, you know, for many years now, but battling the stigma of being an addict and an opiate addict
I think I got you, Josh, and thanks for sharing your story and good luck on your continued recovery there. Let's start with that last point he was making, Jennifer. Do you see stigma as an obstacle to people seeking help?
Yes, stigma can definitely be an obstacle for people seeking help. And so as parents, what we really need to do, and as teachers, as counselors, is obviously meet the person where they're at and not judge them. So, like I said before, it really, anybody could be using substances on whatever level that might be, whether you're abusing them or you're an addict. It could be our next door neighbor. And so really just not being judgmental, being open to hearing what kids have to say really breaks down that barrier so that kids feel safe. They feel like they can go to adults as they should be able to go to and have those conversations and not feel like they're being judged. And I think that's a huge part of utilizing art therapy, is allowing the clients to express themselves in that nonverbal form, putting things out there, not censoring their art, not censoring their stories.
Talking to Jennifer Tamavong about an art exhibit. It's called In My Shoes. It's at the Milwaukee Central Library right now. An effort to have teens who are going through substance abuse recovery share artistically their experience and send a message to parents as well along the way. Back to our callers now with Mark in Minneapolis. Mark, hi.
Hi. Yes.
Go ahead, Mark.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead, Mark.
Okay. I've had a lot of my friends die from drug and alcohol abuse, actually a majority of them. And the fact that the cheapest and strongest heroin in the U.S. is available in Minneapolis doesn't help things. So, with that being said, I would just like to say, if you go down that road, it's going to happen. It's inevitable. It's inevitable. So, treatment is a necessity for many, many people. However, there's one problem I have with the current state of affairs of the treatment programs available in the upper Midwest, and that is that they're primarily Christian-based. And I'm not a Christian. I don't raise my children Christian. So enough said.
Mark, thanks a lot for the call. So, Jennifer, a couple points there. He's worried that too much faith-based organizations in the healing process. Do you think that that matters one way or the other, Jennifer?
I do think that that can be a big controversy. I know here at Rosecrans we really try to focus on spirituality versus a specific faith-based program. Like I had said before, we do focus on the 12 steps, but in the 12 steps it talks about God as you see him. So if that means that your higher power is nature, then we really encourage clients to go in that direction. If your higher power is something that's faith-based, we encourage clients to go in that direction. I think a big thing that makes us stand out at Rosecrans is using the spiritual aspect versus a faith-based program.
Well, I want to bring things home to the In My Shoes exhibit. You told us a little bit about what these teens going through substance abuse recovery shared in this project on these shoes that they've decorated. In talking to them, are they hoping that not only they're expressing themselves, but maybe they're making a difference for the next person who might be in their situation, or maybe to help them avoid that situation in the first place?
Yeah, I think the main purpose of this was for them to share their life story, for them to continue on in treatment here and be able to talk with their parents about that. But I also believe that, and some of the clients have shared that they're really glad that they've been able to get their stories out there to help other people, to allow other parents and teens realize that there is help out there of all different levels. So maybe inpatient treatment isn't the correct level of treatment for you. Maybe it's something else. But there's help out there of all sorts of levels.
And is there a next step beyond In My Shoes to use art to work with your clients to heal and to share their story?
Well, this is a project that we do every year, so we'll definitely continue with that. I know that there are other projects in the making that we're kind of going with to really just continue to share their story, to allow clients to find that hope and that peace. And so, we're just going to continue working with that.
All right, Jennifer, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Jennifer Tamavong. She's a certified alcohol and drug counselor and art therapist at Rosecrans, a Rockford, Illinois-based teen substance abuse treatment center. Now, this In My Shoes exhibit we've been talking about, it is on display now at Milwaukee's Central Library, going to stay there through April 26th. After that, it'll move to the first floor rotunda of the state capitol in Madison. You can see it there from May 11th. To May 22nd. And by the way, you can keep this conversation going. Send us a message over at the Central Time Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Let us know if you've seen this exhibit and what you thought of it.